The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Monday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. James Blind is producing today's program, Clark Hilton Engineering, and Dan Rice has given up the use of his office for the sake of the cause. You know, it's that quarantine thing. Well, today we're going to talk with Elaine Kennelly. She is the author of Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss, Healing Truths for Those Not Yet Healed. She is the mother of an 18-year-old who some 30 years ago took his own life. She explains in some painstaking detail the challenge she faced, even walking away from her faith in the process of healing. It's an honest book. She offers incredible insight for those who are struggling following a suicide, but also for those of us who want to minister to those who are in this kind of significant, unparalleled grief. So she's going to be joining us in the second hour of today's program. I hope that you will join us for that. I also want to mention a little bit about tomorrow's program. We're going to be joined by our friends at World Concern for their radiothon. Now, there is a crisis and an emergency. We're going to be talking about it. It will be somewhat familiar to you, but we're going to bring you up to date on the crisis that you're probably not going to read in the headlines or hear in the top stories on the news, but it is a crisis and an emergency nonetheless. That's coming up tomorrow on the program, and I hope you will make some appointment radio and join us, because we need your help to save the children in this region. First, taking a look at some of the day's headlines, President Biden is approaching his 100-day milestone. And in politics, particularly presidential politics, that's considered significant. Well, as he closes in on the 100th mark of his, the 100th day mark of his presidency, a Fox News poll finds a 54% majority of voters approve of his job performance. Now, that's lower than Barack Obama's 62% and George W. Bush's 63% approval at their respective 100-day points, higher than the 45% Donald Trump received 4 years ago, however. Well, there is an 81-point gap, on approval of President Biden between Democrats at 95% and Republicans at 14%. That's even a bit wider than the 76% partisan gap for former President Trump in April of 2017. In addition, concern about coronavirus stands at a record low and the highest percentage ever since the virus is at least somewhat under control. Well, depending on what part of the country you're in, 81% feel it's under control, an increase of 34 percentage points since December. Well, that's the best news in the poll for Biden. By a 31-point margin, voters say border security is worse than it was 2 years ago. A 56% majority thinks Biden winning the election is completely or mostly behind the increase in migrants at the U.S. southern border. And 67% are extremely or very concerned about illegal immigration. Well, views on the economy are more than 2-to-1 negative. 29% rate it as excellent or good, and 69% say only fair to poor. Well, that's little change since the end of the Trump term, when it was 33-66% respectively. However, in January of 2020, before the pandemic, 55% rated economic conditions positively, including a record 20% saying excellent. Well, in other developments, McCarthy is slamming Biden's first 100 days as bait and switch after promises of bipartisanship. We haven't seen much of that. Meanwhile, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says Biden exceeded progressive expectations in his first 100 days. Meanwhile, Mark Levin says Republicans cannot stand by as the demagogues of the Democrat Party tear this country apart. Well, a new MIT study is challenging indoor social distancing, finding no difference between 6 feet and 60 feet. Well, the new study from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology challenges the widespread social distancing guidelines, asserting that the 6-foot rule is inadequate in mitigating indoor transmission of COVID-19. Well, MIT professors Martin Bazant and John Bush, they found that people who maintain 6 feet of distance indoors are no more protected than if they were 60 feet apart, even when wearing a mask. Well, the peer-reviewed study published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America focused on factors such as time spent indoors, air filtration and circulation, immunization and variant strains. What our analysis continues to show, they write, is that many spaces that have been shut down, in fact, don't need to be. Bazant explained to CNBC, saying oftentimes the space is large enough, the ventilation is good enough, the amount of time people spend together is such that those spaces can be safely operated even at full capacity, and the specific, the scientific support for reduced capacity in those spaces is really not very good. I think if you run the numbers, even right now for many types of spaces, you find that there is not a need for occupancy restrictions, he added. Well, both Bazant and Bush teach applied mathematics, while Bazant also teaches applied chemistry. As such, the professors developed a calculation to determine the risk of exposure to COVID-19. In other developments, Dr. Fauci acknowledges outdoor COVID-19 transmission is low and expects updated mask guidance. He and the CDC seem to be at odds. We'll see what comes out next. Well, fully open Texas and Florida are reporting fewer COVID cases than Democrat-led Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York. And the European Union will let vaccinated Americans visit this summer, according to officials. An Arizona parent is slamming the school board for a double standard. They hosted a retirement party within their ranks, but they canceled the prom. Well, the Oscars 2021 saw Nomadland receive Best Picture as celebrities ripped Derek Chauvin and police brutality. Apparently, entertainment is no longer the focus of the Oscars. The 2021 Oscars on Sunday saw Nomadland take home the top prize as Best Picture in an awards show that featured countless celebrities referencing Derek Chauvin's murder conviction and police brutality in the United States. We give this one to our wolf. Frances McDonald, one of the film's stars and producer, said before howling to the ceiling as she accepted the accolade. She also asked viewers to watch the film on the largest screen possible at movie theaters very, very soon. McDormand also took home the award for Best Actress for the film. Trayvon Free, one of the directors of Two Distant Strangers, discussed police brutality in his acceptance speech for the film's win for Best Live Action Short Film. Today, the police will kill three people, and tomorrow, the police will kill three people. And the day after that, the police will kill three people, because on average, the police in America every day kill three people, he said, joined by co-star Desmond Rowe. Now, there was no context given to those numbers. He continued, those people have been disproportionately black people. I ask that you please not be indifferent. Please don't be indifferent to our pain. In other development, Tyler Perry's Oscar speech went viral. My mother taught me to refuse to hate. He even made reference to refusing to hate police officers. The Academy Awards venue change forced the crew to deal with a higher crime area in Los Angeles. And the Oscars didn't require attendees to wear face masks during the telecast, because we've learned early on that the COVID-19 is a respecter of persons, position, and apparently level of influence. Or maybe not. Well, L.A.'s homeless relocated ahead of the Oscars ceremony. Huh. Well, Elon Musk says that a bunch of people will probably die during the Mars mission. Thanks for the warning, Elon Musk. Wyoming Roofing Company is offering free AR-15s with every installation. The owner is firing back at the backlash. And hunting, gun sports app Go Wild is seeing a rise in ammunition scams. Well, Disneyland is going to reopen this week, but with no parades, no fireworks, or hugs. Now, is it still Disneyland without all of that? You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. I want to remind you, coming up in the second hour of today's program, we'll talk with Elaine Canelli. She's the author of Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss, Healing Truths for Those Not Yet Healed. The book is published by Morgan James Publishing. That's coming up in the second segment of the second hour of today's program. Continuing to take a look at some of the day's headlines. While the CDC says open states like Texas and Florida are doing much better than closed blue states, Republican-led states, including Texas and Florida, are reporting fewer coronavirus cases than Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York, all of which are led by prominent Democrats who refuse to roll back COVID-19 regulations and statewide mask mandates, according to CDC data. Texas Governor Greg Abbott was widely criticized by the left after he completely reversed the state's mandate on the 10th of March and fully reopened his state. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was also accused of endangering Florida residents when he allowed businesses to fully reopen in September without a mask mandate in place. Well, a Seattle pastor canceled a Charlie Kirk appearance due to terrorist threats. It's rather sad to see a pastor cave to such fears. He says the Seattle police were on board, but he wasn't confident that the leaders in Seattle would protect his people. San Francisco residents are shocked by the actions of a left-wing DA, particularly women in the area. From the story, after taking office, the DA began cutting prosecutors and dropping charges in serious cases, notably ones in which a man allegedly attacked police officers with a vodka bottle. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, women's advocates are alarmed as well by the attorney general's tendency to release domestic violence offenders, including a man who was arrested on suspicion of killing a seven-month-old baby and was released. Well, the progressive DA has a tendency to release and not charge those arrested for felony domestic violence. When Chesa Boudin, who's the DA, was sworn in as DC, as a DA rather, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor sent a congratulatory video and compared his path to her own. Well, female athletes plan to appeal a federal ruling that males can compete against females. The problem is females can't compete against males because their biology gives them a decided disadvantage. A federal court ruled against them over the weekend. Maricopa County ballots and voting machines are now in Republican hands. From the story, the state Senate used its subpoena power to take possession of all 2.1 million ballots in Maricopa County and the machines that counted them, along with computer hard drives full of data. We'll keep an eye on that one. Well, Facebook is upset. Phones will require you to agree to let them use your personal data. If they have to ask, they realize people will say no. So when you're asked, keep in mind you do have that option. Well, progressives lose their first Biden-era special election in a heavily Democrat district in Louisiana. The Democrats chose the more moderate candidate. Now, what does this mean moving forward? Maybe not much, but it is at least one bellwether for now. In health, the FDA has lifted their Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause. New CDC guidance recommends pregnant women, I guess these days, they're interchangeable, get the COVID vaccine. And India hits new COVID record with 352,991 infections. The United States has vowed to come alongside and help. And a malaria vaccine is striking early success after decades of disappointment. Well, the State Department's social justice warriors are allowing embassies to fly gay pride flags on the same pole as the U.S. flag. That is unprecedented. And DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, has stopped fines for illegal immigrants who fail to leave the U.S., and they've canceled their debt as well. President Biden declared the slaughter of Armenians a genocide, posing a test for U.S. ties with Turkey. He's the first U.S. president to do so directly, because of the relationship the United States has enjoyed, in quotes, with Turkey. Well, the U.S. military begins its final withdrawal from Afghanistan. The exit creates new hurdles for counterterrorism operations. You can read more in the New York Times and the Washington Times on the subject. Well, Portland's Democrat mayor is now begging the public, to help unmask members of the self-described anarchist mob. Reckless Gavin Newsom is going to phase out fracking, he says, in 2024 and end oil extraction in California by 2045. Of course, he won't be in office at that time. It will be someone else's problem to achieve. Indiana has declared houses of worship essential services, finally. And Montana has passed a law that prohibits federal gun restrictions. We're calling it a recruiting crisis. Police officers are retiring in droves. NYPD is experiencing a 75% spike in departures and retirements. Will we all be better off when there are fewer law enforcement officers? Well, this day in history, 1933, Nazi Germany's infamous secret police, the Gestapo, is created. 1968, the United States detonates a 1.3 megaton nuclear device called Boxcar beneath the Nevada desert. 1986, an explosion and fire at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine caused radioactive fallout to begin spewing into the atmosphere. Dozens of people were killed in the immediate aftermath of the disaster, and the long-term death toll from radiation poisoning is believed to have been in the thousands. And finally, on this day in history, 1994, voting begins in South Africa's first all-race elections, resulting in victory for the African National Congress and the inauguration of Nelson Mandela as president. I mentioned earlier that the Oscars were, well, boring and woke. For everyone who missed it last night, and according to the numbers, quite a few people did, Hollywood celebrated its 93rd Academy Awards. Given recent trends, everybody who missed it would be most folks. Nevertheless, it's apparent that for all its loudly declared concerns over inclusivity, Hollywood has failed to include the interests of the vast majority of the American public. Hence the numbers. Exclusivity was the better word to describe yet another abysmally woke Oscars, as the New York Post Johnny Olenkeski or something very like that put it. If you opened the window and listened closely Sunday night, you could hear it, the sound of millions of remote controls changing the channel during the 2021 Oscars. But it wasn't just the over-the-top and yet somehow monotonous leftist messaging, which has turned so many Americans off with Hollywood and the Oscars. It was also the fact that, as USA Today's Kelly Lawler observed, the producers apparently forgot one of the key elements of filmmaking: show, don't tell. In other words, it was a boring program, arduously progressing through all the obligatory woke issues. It's become increasingly apparent that Hollywood has severed itself from what made it so big in the first place: entertainment. Remember when Hollywood was entertaining? It's now little more than an institutional leftist shill touting diversity and inclusivity, but being completely devoid of genuine diversity of opinion and thought. It's like an orchestra with a complete complement of musicians capable of playing an array of instruments, but they only ever play one tune, or for that matter, one note. Of course, the media praised the event as innovative, a humorous way to get around the fact that producers attempted to hold an in-person award ceremony while also social distancing due to California's COVID restrictions. They probably should have held it in, Florida, Texas. And it might have worked if it weren't for the commitment to radical virtue signaling. Well, last night's hostess, actress Regina King, explained in her opening monologue how the show was being done in person with everyone vaxxed, tested, retested, and socially distanced. Then, just to keep the systematic racism narrative going, she added, "I have to be honest, if things had gone differently this week in Minneapolis, I would have traded in my heels for marching boots." Apparently, she didn't feel she needed to march. Anyway, on that same narrative, director Travon Free, who received an award for Best Live Action Short, stated, "Today the police will kill three people." I kind of went over that earlier in the program. Finally, why should any of us care what Hollywood is doing or who or what celebrities are honoring? It's a fair question, as Hollywood has long dismissed and derided conservatives and mainstream Americans as a bunch of racist bigots who deserve nothing but ridicule. It's important to observe what these cultural influencers are preaching, however, if only to be informed as to be better prepared to confront and challenge their message when your neighbors or your kids parrot the same thing. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, he happens to be a Republican, is a dangerous man, which is why the left can't decide whether to ignore him or smear him. Well, Scott was raised in poverty by a single mom, went on to graduate from Charleston Southern University, built a successful small business, and eventually won election to the U.S. House of Representatives before becoming the first black politician since Reconstruction to represent a Southern state in the U.S. Senate. Now, you would think these are commendable things, but He's Republican, so that's not the case. Well, that's a pretty impressive life story for a guy whose grandfather dropped out of elementary school to pick cotton on the family farm. Well, for the Washington Post's resident fact checker, Glenn Kessler, the story is too good to be true. I mean, you can't be Republican and have that history. And with Scott having been tapped by GOP leadership to deliver the Republican Party's response to President Joe Biden's first speech to a joint session of Congress on Wednesday, the Post obviously felt Scott could no longer be ignored, which meant smearing him. And smear him they are. As Kessler writes, our research reveals a more complex story than what Scott tells audiences. In other words, he can't be believed. Scott's grandfather, his grandfather's father, was also a substantial landowner. And Scott's grandfather, Artis Ware, worked on that farm. Scott's family history in South Carolina offers fascinating window into a little-known aspect of history in the racist South following the Civil War and in the immediate aftermath of slavery, that some enterprising black families purchased property as a way to avoid sharecropping and achieve a measure of independence from white-dominated society. But that's not to be admired. Because South Carolina Senator Tim Scott is a Republican. We should note first that Kessler's article is behind the Post's paywall. That means hardly anyone is going to read it beyond the ominous headline, Tim Scott often talks about his grandfather and cotton. There's more to that tale. So most people who are not subscribers won't go beyond that, but his reputation has been called into question. In fact, there isn't much more to that story at all. As the Federalist Jordan Davidson points out, using the guise of a fact check, Kessler spent nearly 30 paragraphs analyzing census documents and other records to try to counteract Scott's claims that his grandfather left elementary school to pick cotton and never learned to read or write. He was bent on disproving that fact. Well, why? Why disprove that fact? Well, because South Carolina Senator Tim Scott is a Republican. Well, Davidson continues, while the article sets out to prove Scott wrong, it confirms the narrative that the senator has repeated in his book and from the political podium multiple times. While Scott believed his grandfather, Artis Ware, dropped out of school in third grade, Kessler claimed to have uncovered that Ware may have left school in the fourth grade, a slight inconsistency, third grade, fourth grade, which Kessler admitted could occur because the records were old. Well, stop the press. Senator Scott's grandfather may have dropped out of school after the fourth grade instead of the third grade. It can't be confirmed, but it sows some doubt into the senator's record. Well, as Dana Loesch tweeted, the white leftists trying to nullify Tim Scott's family experience out of anger that they moved up in life and that he became Republican are the same ones that defended Elizabeth Warren's wholly baseless claim to be of indigenous ancestry. Well, Sean Davis noted that Kessler himself lives in something of a glass house, given that his great-grandfather, Augustin Kessler, particularly built Royal Dutch Shell, a company whose World War II era history is one of sympathy for the devil. Your ancestors literally fueled the Nazi war machine. And as Davis points out, what you're really upset about is that Tim Scott's family were poor sharecroppers. Yikes, dude, she goes on to say. Well, I won't continue with the story, but this is what passes as fact-checking and journalism. And we're talking about South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, who's been pegged to respond to President Biden's State of the Union address. He is the first U.S., he built a successful small business, eventually won election to the U.S. House of Representatives before becoming the first black politician since Reconstruction to represent a southern state in the U.S. Senate. And that's a pretty impressive life story for a guy whose grandfather dropped out of elementary school, third or fourth grade, couldn't read, to pick cotton on the family farm. But this is the era that we live in. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif claimed in a recent leaked audio that John Kerry, when he was serving as Secretary of State during the Obama administration, informed him of more than 200 Israeli operations in Syria. Now, Kerry has previously been accused of colluding with Iranian leaders to undermine the Trump administration. Kerry is now a part of the Biden administration and has a seat on the National Security Council as the special presidential envoy for climate. Kerry shocked Zarif by revealing that Israel had attacked Iranian targets in Syria more than 200 times, according to the leaked audio obtained by the New York Times and other outlets. Zarif also spoke frankly about his limited power compared to Ayatollah Ali Khomeini and the blow the U.S. dealt to Iran by killing General Qassem Soleimani in January of last year. Kerry faced criticism on Monday over Zarif's claim. Well, John Kerry was ratting out Israeli covert operations in Syria directly to Iranian foreign minister. Let that sink in. Wow. That's a quote from Noah Pollack of the foreign policy focused Democratic Alliance Group, writing on Twitter. A former special advisor for Iran at the State Department, Gabriel Norans, he weighed in on Zarif's lasting political career despite his differences with others in the Iranian government. The main reason Zarif was survived by, or rather as foreign minister for 8 years in Iran's cutthroat political environment, is that he serves as the reasonable storefront to the world, protecting the more empowered radical elements of the regime from Western and press scrutiny, Nourani said in a statement. Most of the time, Zarif's foreign ministry is relegated to the job of marketing and PR team, justifying and defending the policy choices of the Iranians and supreme leader Khomeini abroad. I think the leak was likely instigated by regime insiders who have long hated Zarif and tried to oust him. They oppose current efforts to rejoin the GCPOA and has also wanted to bolster domestic opposition to President Rouhani and his allies running for office in June. Meanwhile, President Biden on Saturday became the first U.S. president to formally recognize the systematic deportation and massacre of Armenians by the Ottoman Empire as a genocide, something the successive White Houses have declined or avoided out of concern for damaging relations with Turkey. Each year on this day, we remember the lives of all those who died in the Ottoman era, Armenian genocide, and recommit ourselves to preventing such an atrocity from ever again occurring, Biden said in a statement marking the Armenian Remembrance Day. An estimated 2 million Armenians were deported, 1.5 million killed between 1915 and 1925 in what has become known as Meds Yaghurn. Beginning in April of 1915 with the arrest of Armenian intellectuals and community leaders in Constantinople by Ottoman authorities, 1.5 million Armenians were deported, massacred, or marched to their deaths in a campaign of extermination, Biden said. We honor the victims of the Meds Yaghurn so that the horrors of what happened are never lost in history. And we remember so that we remain ever vigilant against the corrosive influence of hate in all its forms. So Biden had promised to recognize the horrific events as a deliberate effort to wipe out Armenians during the 2020 presidential campaign. He had argued that failing to recognize it as such would pave the way for future atrocities, something he himself hinted at in his statement. Well, Florida and Texas gained House seats, while California and New York lost one seat each as a result of population shifts, according to the 2020 census results announced today. Texas gained 2 House seats in the census apportionment for a new total of 38 congressional districts, while Florida gained 1 House seat, bringing its total number of districts to 28. California lost 1 House seat and will decline to 52 congressional districts, while New York also lost 1 House seat and will now have 26 congressional districts. Those 4 states are the nation's most populous and together provide 1/3 of the House's total seats. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Quick break. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. I want to remind you that in the second hour of today's program, I'll have a conversation with Elaine Kennelly. She's the author of Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss, Healing Truths for Those Not Yet Healed. The book is published by Morgan James Publishing. We were talking about the census and the fact that Florida and Texas have gained seats in the House. New York and California have lost them. James pointed out during our break that if Mario Cuomo hadn't put so many people in the nursing home, that 89 dropped them from in the House might have been enough to maintain their House seat. Anyway, census officials noted that New York had counted 89 more people. The state would have would not have lost their House seat. Okay, that was a little convoluted, but I think you get the idea. They had 89 more people. They wouldn't have lost a seat if Cuomo hadn't lost so many in the nursing homes due to COVID. Well, you know the rest. Well, the population of California stopped growing several years before the pandemic. And in 2020, the state lost more residents to out migration, as they call it, than it gained. Residents have migrated to Texas as well as neighboring states like Arizona, Nevada, and Oregon. Speaking of which, steady population growth here, driven by newcomers from other states, including California, is giving Oregon greater national political clout. The U.S. Census Bureau figures released today show that the state's population expanded over the past decade, enough to give Oregon an additional congressional district for the first time in 40 years. Expanding its U.S. House seat from 5 to 6 won't necessarily be a win for Democrats, who control the state politically and hold all but one of the current seats. Democrats agreed to give up their advantage in redrawing political boundaries and a deal to stop Republicans from blocking legislation. So we'll see how that all pans out. Meanwhile, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced that the Justice Department is launching an investigation into the Louisville-Jefferson County Metro Government and the Louisville Police Department. Garland said during a brief address today, this afternoon, that the Department of Justice will be conducting a pattern or practice investigation into the Kentucky City's police 1 year after Breonna Taylor died after being shot by a Louisville police officer in her apartment while they were executing a search warrant. It will determine whether LMPD engaged in unconstitutional stops, searches, and seizures, as well as whether the department unlawfully executes search warrants on private homes. Well, the probe comes as Louisville has seen a surge in violent crime. According to police statistics, murders, rapes, and robberies were up more than 81% above the five-year average in January and February. Now, this follows a 2020 where police retirements and resignations were at a five-year high after Taylor's death. Approximately 15% of the police force left during that time. Well, accompanied by newly confirmed Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco and Associate Attorney General Vanita Gupta, Garland stated that the investigation will look into whether Louisville police engage in discriminatory conduct on the basis of race as part of what will be a comprehensive review of the department's policies and practices. Now, this is the second such investigation that Garland will be announcing in the span of less than a week. On Wednesday, the Attorney General announced a similar investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department following the murder conviction of former officer Derek Chauvin for the death of George Floyd. Garland noted that the city of Louisville has already taken some steps toward reform, including as part of a settlement with Taylor's family. We commend those measures and our investigation will take them into account. Well, similar probes were commonly used by the Obama administration and, as Garland noted when announcing the Minneapolis investigation, have often resulted in consent decrees whereby police departments must comply with various measures to institute reforms regarding policies and practices. The cities of Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore entered into consent decrees under the Obama administration following the deaths of Michael Brown and Freddie Gray, respectively, despite neither situation resulting in police officers being found guilty of crimes. Chicago entered into a consent decree under the Trump administration in 2019. Garland said that if no agreement can be reached with Louisville, they will bring a civil lawsuit seeking court orders. Merrick Garland had told law enforcement officials last Friday that more police departments could be under investigation following his announcement of the Minneapolis probe. Well, the Supreme Court has announced Monday that it's going to take up a major Second Amendment case next term that centers on a New York law which prohibits the concealed carry of handguns in public. The Supreme Court accepted a bid by two gun owners and a New York subsidiary of the National Rifle Association, and they're challenging the state's rejection of their application for concealed carry licenses for self-defense. Well, in an order released today, the justices said that they're going to consider whether the state's denial of petitioners' applications for concealed carry licenses for self-defense violated the Second Amendment. Now, the lawsuit was filed on behalf of complainants Robert Nash and Brandon Koch, after New York officials claimed the individuals did not meet the standard of special need or proper cause to qualify to hold firearms under state law. Now, the state typically reserves concealed carry licenses for security professionals or others who can plausibly claim they face grave threats due to their occupation or public identity. Unlicensed individuals can keep handguns in their homes, but are prohibited from traveling with them or carrying them in public. Nash and Koch contend that the state's limit on concealed carries are an infringement upon their Second Amendment liberty. The plaintiffs argue in their cert petition that the law on the books makes it virtually impossible for the ordinary law-abiding citizen to obtain a license. Well, according to the Giffords Law Center, a gun control activist organization, New York is one of 31 states that require citizens to acquire a permit in order to carry a concealed weapon. Over 10 years have passed since the High Court heard arguments and released a decision concerning the constitutional rights to bear arms. The court will hear the case of New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Corlett in the fall. Well, the court's announcement follows the Biden administration's pledge to address and expand gun control since the nation experienced several mass shootings in recent years. The justices' rulings on the dispute could be transformative for the scope of the Second Amendment. The ideological makeup of the court has solidified into a 6-3 conservative majority since the appointment and confirmation of originalist Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And of course, the debate continues among Democrats as to whether and how to pack the Supreme Court. I shouldn't say there's a debate within the Democrat Party, but there is a disagreement between the Democrats and the Republicans on the subject. Meanwhile, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed legislation into law on the 23rd that prohibits transgender females or biological males from joining girls, biological females, sports teams, which will protect biological female athletes to compete on a fair playing field for scholarships and other athletic accomplishments. The new law reads, well, the legislation, HB 391, was initially passed by the Alabama House, 74-19 in March, and then the Alabama Senate, 25-5, earlier this month. Well, State Representative Scott Stradhagen, who introduced the bill, said in February, basically this bill, whatever your birth certificate says, if it says you are male or you are female, that is the sport you will play K through 12 in athletics. One cannot change the course of one's athletic competition based on choices made later. I think this is more of a women's right issue, he added. You know, this is something that we definitely have to stay on top of. We have roughly about 16 other states that have filed legislation that is similar to this one, and I'm excited about it, end quote. Well, under the new law at public K through 12 schools, athletic events allowing competition by one biological gender against another are prohibited unless the event specifically includes both genders. The law also declares the following: physical differences between biological males and biological females have long made separate and sex-specific sports teams important so that female athletes can have equal opportunities to compete in sports. Physical advantages for biological males relevant to sports include, on average, a larger body size with more skeletal muscle mass, a lower percentage of body fat, and greater maximal delivery of anaerobic and aerobic energy than biological females. On average, biological male athletes are bigger, faster, stronger, and more physically powerful than their biological female counterparts. This results in a significant sports performance gap between the sexes. Testosterone suppression in biological males does not result in a level playing field between biological male and biological female athletes. Because of the physical differences between biological males and biological females, having separate athletic teams based on the athlete's biological sex reduces the chances of injury to biological female athletes, and promotes sex equality. And it goes on from there. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. We need to take a break for news. And then we'll hear, we'll go to our next segment and in the second hour, I should say, of the program, Elaine Kennelly, Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to the second hour of The Georgene Rice Show. Coming up in our next segment this hour, we'll have a conversation with Elaine Kennelly, Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss, Healing Truths for Those Not Yet Healed. She lost some 30 years ago, her 18-year-old son to suicide. She's very candid about her experience. It's an unflattering portrait of a woman who was overwhelmed by grief, turned her back on God, and went in the depths of despair for a long period of time until ultimately she was able to restore her relationship with Christ and experience joy and peace again. Elaine Kennelly is the author. It might be a good book for your church library. One of the things she mentions in the book is the fact that because it was a suicide, she found herself quite alone. And even her church and Christian friends stayed away. There are a variety of reasons why that might be the case, but there's tremendous advice based on her experience and the experience of many others, how one might minister to those who've lost a loved one or close friend due to suicide. Anyway, she'll be joining us in our next couple of segments. Well, federal taxes, spending, and the federal deficit all set records in the first 6 months of fiscal year 2021. According to the monthly Treasury statement, federal taxes climbed to a record, well, I can't even say the number, in the October through March period, while federal spending climbed precipitously. The gap between the record federal tax collections and the record federal spending in the October through March period resulted in a record federal deficit. When the October through March deficit numbers for previous fiscal years are adjusted for inflation into constant March 2021 dollars using the Bureau of Labor Statistics inflation, their calculator, the second highest deficit for the first 6 months of the fiscal year was in 2009. That year, the October through March deficit was in significant high numbers. Well, the highest October through March federal spending before this year took place in fiscal 2009, when the federal government spent above its means in constant dollars, also gives reason for pause. And federal health officials lifted an 11-day pause on the use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine on Friday, following a review and the recommendation of a panel of experts who determined it met safety standards despite rare instances of severe blood clots. The Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention lifted the pause shortly after a CDC advisory panel recommended a resumption of its use. The panel recommended inclusion of language warning the public of a risk of blood clots upon receiving the single dose vaccine. We have concluded that the known potential benefits of the Janssen COVID-19 vaccine outweigh its known and potential risks in the individuals 18 years of age and older. That's a quote from Acting FDA Commissioner Janet Woodcock in a statement. We are confident that this vaccine continues to meet our standards for safety, effectiveness, and quality, end quote. Well, health officials paused the rollout of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on the 13th of this month in response to six reported cases of thrombosis syndrome, or TTS. At the time, the FDA said it had recommended a pause. Subsequent safety review out of an abundance of caution, which they now say they have concluded. The FDA and CDC say that they have identified a total of 15 cases among nearly 8 million recipients, all of which occurred in women between 18 and 59. Three of the women died, seven remain hospitalized. Officials said symptoms associated with the blood clots appeared between 6 and 15 days after the vaccination. At this time, the available data suggests that the chance of TTS occurring is very low, but the FDA and CDC remain vigilant in continuing to investigate this risk, the agency said in their press release. Well, European regulators reached a similar decision earlier this week and allowed the rollout of Johnson & Johnson vaccine to resume there. Johnson & Johnson said it was grateful for the advisory committee and its medical experts for the rigorous evaluation of its COVID-19 vaccine. The committee's recommendation is an essential step toward continuing urgently needed vaccination in a safe way for millions of people in the U.S., the company said in a statement. Yesterday afternoon, my sister and I took my mother, 90 years old, for her second vaccination shot. Thus far, she didn't feel the shot. She has no pain in her arm, and she has not had any ill effects from either the first or second, although I'm monitoring her as closely as possible while trying to maintain, hosting a program. So I'm very grateful for that. And I think James mentioned that he had heard So that's secondhand account that for many elderly, the effects of the or the ill effects of the second shot seem to be less than for others. So I hope that is, in fact, the case. Well, B117, it's a variant that's now responsible for most COVID-19 cases in Oregon, according to officials, has now become the dominant strain in Oregon, and it's helping fuel a fourth surge of COVID-19, despite 4 out of every 10 Oregonians having received at least one dose of the vaccine, according to public health officials. Well, as the governor has said repeatedly, this really is a race between vaccination and the spread of COVID-19, especially the spread of B117 variant, which we believe now is a majority of cases in the state. Oregon Health Authority Director Patrick Allen told a group of lawmakers last week that this particular variant was first detected last December in the UK as it sent COVID-19 cases skyrocketing, and some studies say led to an increase in more serious disease, including a 55% increase in death. A definitive answer is still unclear. However, with at least two other studies finding B117 didn't result in more hospitalizations or severe cases. Well, officials warned that the American public in February that they expected B117 to become the dominant strain in the U.S. by March. And one study found the variant was doubling in cases every 10 days. Earlier this month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced that it had become the dominant strain in the U.S., with some estimates pinning it at 50% more contagious than the previous most common strain in the country. Well, it took roughly 2 more weeks after the CDC's announcement on the 7th of this month before Oregon officially concluded that B117 was accounting for most cases in Oregon as well. In the third week of March, it was accounted for 8% of the cases analyzed variants. A week later, 24%, rose to 30% by the following week. The next week, the 4th through the 10th of April, B117 made up an eye-popping 53% of cases. And that has continued, apparently, to increase. Well, officials say that they can't extrapolate with the certainty to say that by April 10th, it's accounting for 53% of all coronavirus cases, because only about 3% of cases in Oregon are analyzed for variants. But the rapid rise is dominating, surpassing strains first identified in California. New cases over the past 2 weeks have been accelerating faster in Oregon than any other state in the country, with a 63% increase in the past 2 weeks, according to the New York Times ranking of states. Oregon ranks 25th overall in new cases per capita over that same time period. Over the past month, cases have ballooned from a daily average of 281 to 776 as of Saturday, a 176% increase. The number of hospitalizations has grown from 109 to 295 as of Saturday, a 171% increase. Well, coming up, we're going to have a conversation with Elaine Canelli. She's the author of Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss, Healing Truths for Those Not Yet Healed. So stay with us. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. We're glad to have you with us. Our next guest addresses a very difficult subject, and I am so grateful that she has been willing to talk about the subject of suicide, because so many find themselves in despair and don't quite know where to go. She writes in her book that 30 years have passed since that awful day. The way through was often gut-wrenching, but we did find our way to the other side. And for those who are facing a loss of a family member or friend, it's difficult to recognize that there may be hope at the end of this very long and dark tunnel. Well, we live in an age of lockdowns and shutdowns and isolation. Depression is rampant. Alcohol and drug sales are up. Suicide is a growing mental health crisis. And in fact, there have been a 60% jump in suicide since 2007 among young people, and this has increased in this last year. Well, in her book, Finding Peace After a Suicide, author and businesswoman Elaine Canelli, she describes her journey saying that she was spiritually lost. She was mired in bitterness and self-pity, overwhelming sorrow, guilt, depression, sorrow, anger, bitterness, abandonment, and rejection. That is a heavy burden. She said suicide pain shows no mercy, and she spent years clawing her way out of her pain and sorrow. Well, suicide is our nation's silent pandemic. Over 800,000 suicide deaths in 2018 worldwide. And my guest says that nothing prepares us for a loved one's suicide. That is certainly the case. Well, Elaine Kennelly is a mom who lost an 18-year-old son to suicide. She's also an accomplished businesswoman who ran an award-winning Hallmark Gold Crown store. She created her own TV show, Elaine's World, and started a Keller Williams Realty Market Center in Huntsville, Alabama. She is a graduate of Concordia University and author of Faith Over Feelings and Something Sisters 31-Day Devotional. Today, she joins us to talk about her latest book, Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss. Elaine Kennelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're so very welcome, Georgine. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I have been friends of two people who committed suicide, one indirectly, the other I attended church services with for a number of years. I would have considered her a close friend. Suicide is like nothing else. You've written about the subject from your own painful experience, but also to provide something of a roadmap for others who are in the midst of the despair I described a bit earlier. You start your book by saying nothing prepares us for a loved one's suicide. Can you tell us a bit of your story?
Yes, and it is absolutely true. Nothing prepared me personally for it. I was stunned. Our entire family was stunned that our 18-year-old son would choose to leave the family. At that time, I had never known of another person who had done that or another family who had suffered like that. And so for me, it was agonizing. I felt that God had abandoned me. Where was he? Where was the God that I knew? Because I had been a Christian my entire life, Georgine. So I really thought that God was going to protect our son, that our son would have a wonderful testimony, that God healed him through his depression, through his bad choices. But he didn't. And that was the battle that I faced. My battle was with God. That where was he? Why did he allow this to happen? And so for me, it took years. It took literally years for me to figure this out. And I just desperately feel for people who have lost a loved one to suicide, especially a child. And that's why I have written the book. I know that it will help many. And what I have found in my life is I basically got stuck. And for, I would say, at least 10 years, I was in that pit of bitterness with no one to help me out. And it's a subject that people don't talk about. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very painful subject, and we don't know what to say. You make the point that oftentimes feeling of rejection is the deepest pain that you felt. Rejection from the son who chose to end his life, rejection from others. Explain what you mean by that and the sense of guilt that you also felt.
Oh, rejection is so part of suicide because your loved one chose to leave the relationship, chose to leave the family. And that is hard to reckon with, whether it's a parent or a spouse, a child, or just a friend. You know, that is a rejection. And for me, it was a deep rejection. I felt that if ever there should be a relationship, it's between mother and child. And he chose to leave that relationship. And I felt that God had rejected me. And really, very few of our friends were there to help. At the very beginning, there was really no one. I mean, people at church even wouldn't sit in the pew with us. It was a dreadful situation. We did not feel loved. We felt abandoned. We did not know where to go with our grief. And so I just took it all inward and just shoved it deep down inside of me. And I found out something that is very truthful. That doesn't work because eventually those feelings do come out of you in ways that you don't like. And so I really struggled for years, feeling abandoned, feeling rejected, even rejected in the community. The stigma was there. And, you know, I would venture to say that the stigma situation hasn't changed much. I don't know if you agree with that, but I have found that people are reluctant not only to talk about it, but they do sense and do sometimes, they're very judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that we, even within the church community, I mean, I was a lifelong Christian, so I had many Christian friends. We were involved in our church, but there was really no one there that even reached out to us in being there or coming to our home or any type of blessing to us. So we were missing so much after Matthew died. And so the hurt went deep, deep inside. And I didn't grieve well. I stuffed all that sorrow deep within me. That wasn't good. Sometimes I even put on the happy mask, you know, we have to keep functioning. And so I did that, and that didn't help me either. So to be very honest with you, I did a lot of things wrong, but I do share that in my book because I do think people need to understand the difficulty with suicide, survival, and healing after a suicide. So I know this book will help mm-hmm. others who are in this situation.
Now, you mentioned that you felt abandoned by the church and even Christian friends and others who mm-hmm. Might otherwise be expected to come alongside and help. I don't want to move on from that because my guess is there are listeners who wonder, what should your friends have done? What should I do in the event mm-hmm. of a friend's loss through a family member's suicide? What would have been mm-hmm. help? Certainly not not abandoning you, but what would have been helpful in that situation?
That is such a great question. I'm glad you're bringing this up because there is really nothing anyone can say immediately after a suicide death because nothing you say is going to really help them at that moment. Now, as the years progress, it would have been nice for people to come back perhaps and say, you know, I wasn't there right after Matthew's death, but would you like to talk about it now? Because afterwards, you are able to gather your thoughts. You really think you're kind of going crazy mm-hmm. after someone takes their life because there are so many issues to deal with. And I think the number one thing that people could do immediately after a suicide loss is to just be there with the family, be there with the person. That ministry of presence, yes. you know, just being there, that would have been so nice. But there was no one to even cry with us. And what really can you say at that point? I mean, yes, God's love is a good message, but you can't take it in at that point. You're just so sad and so full of grief and so sorrowful that you have struggled just getting dressed in the morning, you know, and normalcy yeah. is pretty much gone. And so at the beginning of a suicide loss, if you would just be there with your friend, your sister, your aunt, your uncle, cousin, coworker, whoever it is, that would be just really a great thing for someone to do. Yeah. But then again, as you see them attempting to heal, you might be able to then say something or increase a conversation with them. And of course, just again, being their friend, taking them to lunch, having coffee with someone, giving them an opportunity to talk about the loved one. And that would be wonderful, too. But I know people are afraid to say something wrong, so they say nothing at all. But that really, really needs to be changed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think especially as believers, we feel like, you know, we know mm-hmm. the scriptures. We should have something profound to say. But you're absolutely yeah. right. The ministry of presence is what's needed initially. And then let the Holy Spirit guide you in the future as to what you might say or do. We're talking right. with Elaine Canelli. She's the author of Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss. We're going to continue our conversation in a moment, but I do need to take a quick break. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
You're listening to the Georgine Rice Show, and I'm continuing my conversation with Elaine Canelli. She is the author of Finding Place, rather peace after a suicide loss, healing truths for those not yet healed. It took you a very long time. You write that it was an arduous journey to find a place of healing. For those who are in the midst of that battle, I think just the assurance that there is a light at the end of the tunnel is helpful at this point. Can you describe a bit your journey? You mentioned that you really struggled in the beginning. How did you make your way through to reconciling with God and the questions that you had and finding peace again?
Well, the third part of my book does talk about moving forward, and because I think there is healing available. It is difficult, it is arduous, but there is healing possible. And I found in my walk or in my struggle with God, the first thing that I really had to do was open my heart to Him. I had pretty much told Him that I really wanted nothing to do with Him. If you're the God, if you're going to be a God like this, I really, I'm going to put you on the back burner of my life, and I don't really need you. And I believed a lie that Satan told me, and that lie, and that I told myself quite liberally. I told myself, I can heal on my own. I'm an intelligent woman. I have a good business. I have strengths of my own, and I don't need God. And that was my number one biggest mistake. And that reconciliation did come. God was very patient. He waited for me, and He waited for me. He never really abandoned me. I had abandoned Him. Mm-hmm. And He was there with me through it. I just didn't really want Him there. I didn't really want to pray. But I had to finally say, I miss you, God. And I heard it through one word in a sermon. You know, I still went to church, but I never really participated. For about 5 to 7 years after Matthew died, I really went to church counting the ceiling tiles, never singing the songs, not praying, and just kind of went out of obligation because I had been raised that way. And in that process, though, of counting the ceiling tiles, I must have to say, Georgie, I was there and I heard one word, and it was in a sermon, and it's an old-fashioned word, and the word is solace. I mean, I don't even use that word. Do you?
No.
It's one of those words, but it communicated to me, and I felt a connection with God. And my first step then was to pray. That was my first baby step of healing. And I had to just tell God everything. And you know what? He already knows everything. So He doesn't care if you scream. He doesn't care if you're sarcastic. And I was all of those things. I pointed my finger in God's chest and I said, how could you allow this to happen? But it allowed all my feelings to come out. And since God knew them anyways, it was a wonderful bit of solace for me because I missed God's love. You know, if you isolate yourself and just, you know, rip yourself away from a relationship with God, you really don't feel loved. And I missed that love, that solace, that joy that I had in Jesus Christ. You know, the gift of grace is our greatest gift, and I was missing it. And so it was that solace within my heart. Oh, God, I miss you. And even though, yes, I was angry, I was able to come to Him and tell Him that I missed Him, that I love Him, that I need His love in my life. And that was the baby step. And I do use that terminology, baby step, in my book a lot because that's how all the healing starts, with baby steps, whether it's prayer, whether it's forgiveness, whether it's service in the church, obedience to God, Bible reading, whatever it is, it starts with baby steps. And so I want to encourage your listeners to not be afraid to take a baby step. It it's only the beginning, but God can use that. And that's what he did in my life. It was just, in my marriage, for example, the statistic when Matthew died, the statistic for our marriage was that 94% of all marriages
right.
where a child took their life would end in divorce. So my baby step of a prayer was keep us in the 6%. So I think if one is really hurting, no matter whether it's a suicide or any tragedy, really, think about starting to heal with baby steps in prayer, baby steps in Bible reading. For that, for me, that meant the book of Psalms. Because, you know, the Psalms are so up and down and emotional. And that worked well with that arduous task of trying to heal after suicide. So I could be despondent in Psalm 88, or I could find comfort in Psalm 23. You know, it was just, and there's 150 So you have plenty of room to roam. So I would suggest that is a baby step in healing. And then in forgiveness, of course, that is the most major step of all.
Your book is divided into three parts. I referenced the final part, Hope and Healing, in which your relationship was restored with God. You begin with part one, the death, the sudden sadness and the heavy hearts. And the middle part of the book is the battle, the overwhelming sorrow, and your call for God to just leave you alone, and the responsibility you felt, the guilt that you felt along the way. In our final moments, I want to spend a little time with the battle, because I imagine there are some listeners who are in the midst of that and can't imagine moving on to the hope and healing part of the book. They're in the midst of that battle. Can you talk a little bit about the battle and advice you might give to help them move on to the next phase better than perhaps others might?
The battle is really where people get stuck.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to get out of that pit of bitterness, because when you harden your heart, you will become bitter. And I was bitter. And I was full of self-pity, you know, oh, poor me. And I was filled with guilt, a lot of guilt. And I would think other mothers would feel that way too. I was filled with the whole blame issue. And that happens, especially in marriages, where you blame the other one for doing something or not doing something or saying something. Why did you say that? Or I should have, you know, the should have, could have, would have. And so all those battles just pull you down, and you become so down, you become stuck. And again, I would suggest the fact that you, I think you need to define your battles. Because if you can't name it, you can't really address it. And it may be a minor thing, but to you, it can be a major thing. You know what I'm saying? Everybody will grieve differently. And so I think you need to really emphasize the need to determine what battles you're in. And I think my biggest battle was with forgiveness. I had to forgive a lot of people because I was not a very nice person at that time. And I had to forgive myself. And that took me a long time. And so I struggled with that and that whole issue of forgiveness. But I want to tell your listeners that God's grace always wins. And that is such a beautiful gift to us. We were told back in 1989 when Matthew died that he had now taken the road to hell. We were told that from influential people and from friends. And so my struggle with, is Matthew guilty or not guilty? And I spend a whole chapter of that in my book. And I am happy to share with everyone that God really showed me grace. And God pointed out in Scripture to me many Bible verses that tell us those who believe in Jesus Christ are never condemned. And that was my joy, to understand that God's grace always wins. In fact, Romans 5:21 tells us now God's wonderful grace rules. It is over every sin. And everyone who believes in Jesus Christ has the gift of grace through Jesus Christ. And that's the greatest news that I can share with anyone suffering after a suicide loss, is that I know where my son is. He was a believer in Jesus Christ, and he is home. And it took me years to work that through, but I would encourage everyone to start there and realize and understand God's grace. And if they have trouble finding it in the Bible, go to someone who can help them and choose all those wonderful verses about God's grace through Jesus Christ. And mm-hmm. So that would be a wonderful place to start. But again, it all starts in baby steps. You're not going to heal overnight. And it is a battle. So take those perhaps few friends that you can trust. And ask them, or a pastor, a priest, someone who knows scripture that can share the gospel message so that you understand forgiveness, because that is essential for healing to begin.
We're talking with Elaine Canelli. She is the author of Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to wrap things up. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show, and I'm continuing my conversation with Elaine Canelli. She is the author of Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss, and the subtitle, Healing Truths for Those Not Yet Healed. She walks through her own journey and offers tremendous insight for those who are grieving, with a view to the hope that lies at the end of that very arduous and often painful journey. Now, you touched on this just a moment ago, but you referred to spiritual healing as the ultimate blessing. It took you a while to get there, but explain what you mean by that. Spiritual healing became the ultimate blessing as you navigate through this difficult journey of grieving a suicide loss.
Well, I think I would define grief and recovery after a suicide loss as a spiritual battle. God's domain is life and death, and suicide is a death that has a lot of unanswered questions. And so there was my struggle, that I had to realize that it was between God and me, and I needed to let God be God. The sovereignty of God is a big word for just letting
yes.
God be God. mm-hmm. And I had to understand that. And, you know, I needed help after my suicide loss. I had a psychologist for several years that helped me. And one day he looked at me and he said, "Why not you, Elaine?" And I was rather stunned. And I had to really think about that. Why not me? Am I the only person who should not have any suffering in my life? All of us throughout our life have some suffering. And as Christians, we should expect some suffering in our lives. And so I had to take a look at myself. I had to take a look at God and realize how big God is, how great the magnitude. He doesn't think the way I think. And so I had to let God be God and determine what was going to happen in my life and simply bow, bend the knee and surrender. Mm-hmm. It was that surrender again. That was part of my spiritual battle. And once I surrendered and let God be God, I actually started healing more. And I found more joy in my life. And I want your listeners to know this, that even after a suicide loss, there can be joy in their life. And that's my hope. And, you know, I don't give trite answers in this book. I'm very transparent. I'm very vulnerable with all of the things I did wrong, because I think they will probably do some of that too. So I really wrote this book so that others could be helped through a difficult time in their life.
Yeah. Now, what are the three essential words that you mention at the end of your book, and why are they significant to the healing that you've just described?
Well, the three words are resist, resolve, and rejoice. And resist, I talk about being a spiritual battle, and your battle is going to be with Satan, and we have to resist Satan and all the lies he tells us. You know, I believed a lot of lies, and I think the easiest way to do that is simply say the name of Jesus. So we need to resist any of these lies that come into our head or the things we tell ourselves over and over again that are not right, that mental thought that, you know, just kind of plays over and over again in our brain. So we need to just say the name of Jesus, pray, sing the name of Jesus, whatever it is, Satan will leave. And the next part of it is resolve, because it isn't going to happen without resolution. You have to make a determined effort to heal. And I ask the question, do you want to be healed? Because really, we have to say in our mind, yes, yes, I want out of this pit of bitterness. I want out of my self-pity and blame. And I want to get rid of the guilt. And once we make that mental determination, we resolve to start healing. And that's why I say define your battles. Where do you have to go? What do you have to change? Because your thinking will have to change. Your life will have to change. Your attitude toward God will have to change. But it can if you want to be healed. And then the last thing is rejoice. Even in those little baby steps, I can remember just when I started learning to pray again all over to God, and I found that I could do it, that I was a happier person. Or if I smiled, you know, a smile is a baby step. whichever way you look at it, it's a baby step. But I would walk around, you know, my head down, my brows were furrowed, and I was angry all the time. And instead, I started smiling at people. That was my baby step. And I found joy in that. So just rejoice in those little baby steps in the beginning. And just take it all in, because they're going to have joy again. I want your listeners to know this. After any tragedy, but especially a suicide tragedy, there is joy again to be had in your life.
Well, the book once again is Finding Peace After a Suicide Loss, Healing Truths for Those Not Yet Healed. She is painfully honest, and I think you'll find that these are real answers and a real view into the journey of one woman who came out rejoicing. Elaine Kennelly, thank you so much for the book and for joining us this afternoon. I sure appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I did too.
God bless. We are out of time. I want to remind you tomorrow on the program, we've got our Radiothon with World Concern. I hope you will join us and plan to give generously. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. I want to thank James Blend for producing, Clark Hilton for engineering, Dan Rice for the use of his office. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. If you'd like to download a podcast of the show or would like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com or on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at GRice Show and like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.